It's with great pleasure that I ask you to please welcome David Harris.
This must be something of a re-emergence for me, perhaps. I'm not quite sure, Andrew, where I should begin. My previous experience in history, I wrote on the early public housing debates in Melbourne between 1900 and 1920. My other experiences, Andrew alluded to, where we interviewed him on Triple R on time and place. I did that for 3 years with Chris McConville. Our claim to fame was outrating the ABC on a Monday night. And 9 to 9.30, we owned that. And we also had a following of an odd array, of a loyal following of people. My other experiences with history have, after the MA, I published a few pieces from that. And then I was involved in heritage and heritage conservation and that sort of thing. So this is something of a re-emergence, and there was a long period of gestation with this, I suppose, nearly 20 years. It changed direction, but I had been thinking about something like this for the past 20 years, so that will have to suffice as the introduction of me. Andrew tells me that the that I'm supposed to talk about the project, that my approach and any challenges that I had, and I hope to do that over the next 20-25 minutes. The image that we have up here is of the entrance to the Gippsland Lakes, and the surf is breaking over one of the piers, and the piers were part of an engineering project which was completed in 1889 and needed renovation by the early 1900s. And I suppose it's one of the historical ironies that a project that was intended to subdue nature to the desires of colonists was began to fall apart because of Teredo nivalis, which is a marine mollusk, which was actually spread throughout the world by colonisers. And so the renovations of the entrance to the Gippsland Lakes began in 1900, and presumably there have been other renovations as well. So the approach that I'm going to take with this, I have dot points I'm speaking to, so I'm not going to be reading. The four things that I want to get through, firstly the setting of the thesis on the Gippsland Lakes. Secondly, the ideas which really drove my thinking about the Gippsland Lakes. This, I didn't want to write a local history because there were several really good local histories, John Adams, Peter Simon, and Coral Dow's remarkable environmental history, a PhD, which hasn't been published, but an award-winning PhD, which was on the Gippsland Lakes. So my focus was going to be slightly different from those. I'll talk very briefly just about the structure of the thesis. And then finally, I wanted to look at the archive. And I've curtailed what I was going to do in talking about that. So that's mainly based around visual documents, maps, photographs, and that sort of thing. Well, firstly, the Gippsland was the land, was and is the land of the Gunai Kurnai. In the 19th century, they were known as the Kurnai or Gunai, and then it was only after a recent native title hearing that the name was changed to Gunai Kurnai. During this period, there was an entrance into the lakes, which was a natural entrance, and the rhythm of the lakes was set by that natural entrance. So when the entrance was closed, the lakes would flood back for over 100 kilometres or more. That would fill swamps, which were breeding areas for fish, also for birds as well. When the lake was opened, when the entrance was opened, that was a period of time when fish would breed, salinity on the lakes would change, you would have a diversity of marine life because you had salt wedges which were going through different parts of the lakes, and then there were fresh water as well. So the array of wildlife that was available was extraordinary. It was an incredibly rich environment. And the rhythms of the lakes were set by the seasons. It was set by the flow, the melting snows, by the flows of rivers. There were five rivers that flowed into the lakes or still flow into the lakes. And in common with other areas along the coast, this natural entrance would open and close depending upon the seasons. And the importance of the water for Aboriginal people, not just in this period but after the frontier period, was incredible because it allowed the maintenance of Aboriginal maintenance of contact with traditional practices, because it was possible to avoid having anything to do with white settlers. And so right up until through the 1870s, the lakes were such an important part for maintaining Aboriginal culture. I've missed out sail on that map, so I hope no one is offended by that. The lakes are 69 kilometres long. The lakes wetlands are Ramsar listed. The Mitchell River, this is the bit of technology. Ah, there we go. That's the Mitchell River silt jetties. And they're the longest in the Southern Hemisphere, second longest in the world. But if you go to the Gippsland Lakes to encourage tourists to go there, there are no signs. I don't understand this at all. But one of the things that's happened as a result of the opening of the entrance is that the silt jetties are disappearing, and there doesn't seem to be much discussion about that. I don't know how many years they've got left, but certainly in the time I've been looking at them, there's significant erosion. Gippsland always reminded colonists of somewhere else. For Angus Macmillan, one of the early settlers, it was Caledonia Australis. For the surveyor, Dawson, it reminded him of England. For Henry Lawson, the great Australian nationalist, the East Gippsland coast reminded him of Italy. So Gippsland always seemed to be reminding people of somewhere else. And that's partly the reason why the environment was exploited in the way that it was. It was supposed to conform to what has been called a default landscape, that it was always supposed to be like somewhere else. Okay, the ideas for this. As I said, it's not just the local history, and although local history is an element of it, the thing that I'm interested in is the connections between what was happening on the Gippsland Lakes and what was happening in other colonial sites. A lot of my thinking about the Gippsland Lakes was shaped by the work that I did with my masters. And in particular, the links between what was happening elsewhere, that was one thing. The other thing that I was interested in was the perceptions of the environment. So work leading on from my work on substandard housing and cheap housing in the inner suburbs of Melbourne, where a social reformer may perceive a substandard house as being a slum from the person living in there, they would have perceived it differently. And I think the same thing was really evident the more that I read about the environment. The two books that really galvanised my thinking were Connie Chiang's Shaping the Shoreline, which is a book about fishing in Monterey in California. And the other book was Australian or Melbourne historian Alice Garner's work called A Shifting Shore, which was on Arcachon, a fishing town in France. And in both cases, you have the meeting of competing interests. On the one, both of these historians were looking at the meeting of commercial fishing and tourism in the same place, and then what flows from that. The way that the environment becomes a contested space, and this sort of perspective, you could easily draw a line between the 19th century and now. You don't need to go far with looking at discussions about banning commercial fishing on Port Phillip Bay, or the current debates on the Gippsland Lakes. In fact, there's an extraordinary amount of continuity between the 19th century and what's happening now. So both these historians were both looking at four ideas about space and place and how space and place are used. They were both looking at the environment and looking at landscape. The meeting of those four ideas, if Andrew wanted me to talk about the difficulties that I faced, was trying to deal with space and place, because I found them too abstract. And although I used those ideas of space and place in the first chapter of the thesis, I found that dealing with more tangible ideas of the environment and landscape were much more fruitful for the sorts of points that I was wanting to look at. So, taking those four ideas, I then looked at where the links were. Looked at where the links were, not only on the Gippsland Lakes, but also in North America in particular, and in the rest of the colonial world. Because one of the things that becomes very evident when you're looking at the Gippsland Lakes is the exchange of ideas, not only between Gippsland and England, but also the exchange of ideas between Gippsland and North America. The way that, for example, the fish acclimatizers who were attempting to introduce fish into the rivers that flowed into the Gippsland Lakes, they were importing fish from California. They were importing salmon over from California, breeding it in hatcheries, and then releasing it into the rivers of the Gippsland, the rivers that flowed into the Gippsland Lakes, and this was in 1878. And so there are the links with acclimatisation. There's also the, in just looking at culture, the Jay Arthur, for example, has talked about the way that Australia was a default country, the way that it was supposed to be a place of regular flowing rivers, of a temperate climate, etc., etc. Connie Chiang looks at race in her study of Monterey, the way that the physical changes associated with fisheries and tourism became markers of social difference and reinforced racial, ethnic and class divisions. And on the Gippsland Lakes, this was repeated not only with Aboriginal people but also with Chinese fishers at Metung. And in terms of class, Joseph Taylor looked at the Pacific Northwest and making salmon, and the way that these angling groups that were involved in acclimatisation and in the hatcheries, the way that they sought more than just fish. they moralised, and I quote here, they moralised and gendered a landscape that they preserved and enhanced by appropriating space, controlling behaviour, and reordering nature. And the same sorts of things happened on the Gippsland Lakes with the acclimatisers, with the attempts to control commercial fishing, and also with the exclusion of certain areas from either commercial fishing or angling. This was the structure of the thesis, and I won't go through that, but it just identifies that it was divided in, because I was trying to deal both with a chronology and with particular themes, I divided it into three sections. The first dealing with the attempt to control and dominate nature. Secondly, the exploitation of nature and the use of nature. And then thirdly, those people who made a living from the water, but also excluded others from making a similar living. Finally, the archive. Now, the array of archival material was extraordinary. I came across items at State Library, which hadn't been used before. For example, the a boat captain's diary of where they worked at the natural entrance to the lakes. So there were an extraordinary array. How am I going for time? What I've done here, instead of going through the printed material, we'll just go through the visual material, which is possibly more engaging. This extraordinary photo was taken by Carl Walter. And Carl Walter was a German photographer. It was taken in 1867. And Walter had made a name taking photographs at Corindirk. And obviously there are limitations with using this sort of photographic evidence. And the thing that I found astounding about it was the engagement that he had with these women. And the framing of the photo is equally extraordinary. There it is. Okay. The woman standing, whether that cloak that she seems to be wearing was part of the performance that seems to be here, I don't know. But the framing of the photo with the stick going into the water, being reflected in the water, going to the bed of the lake, it's an extraordinary photo, which and you only realise how extraordinary it is when you compare it with later photos that were taken. In this photo, you get a sense of these women on Lake Tyres who are actually about to go out fishing, that they're in control of this landscape. And the woman in front here appears to be talking to the photographer. So there's a sense of engagement. A few years later, the same photo was rendered by Samuel Calvert. And it's devoid of any of the drama or tension that was present in that previous photograph. And this sentiment, it's a sentimental re-rendering, but it also perhaps reflects the changes that are beginning to happen for Aboriginal people on the lakes with the arrival of Europeans. It's also an interesting contrast to make with later photographs from the 1880s from Kerr's collection, where there's no sense in this that these people are going fishing. There's even the title Gippsland Scenery, they've become a part of the landscape. And it seems a much more passive rendering of Aboriginal engagement with the water and with the land than was evident in that first dramatic shot. And I find this interesting because just because of the way that it's suggesting the changing relationship between Aboriginal people and the lakes, the Aboriginal people in the environment, and the way that they're being moved into the background almost. The next island that I wanted to have a look at was a map from the State Library. And in terms of librarians who are a gift to you, Judith Scurfield was extraordinary, the access that she gave me to maps and the things that she found for me. The thing that's extraordinary about this map is there's a narrative of colonisation in it, and there are so many different layers of meaning. If we just look closely, there are so many aspects of this, considering that it's a map which has been added to between the 1860s and the 1890s. And there is a sense of colonial change. There's the naming of sites which have both Aboriginal and European names. But there's also the use of Aboriginal names, which they don't really fit the model of what sorts of Aboriginal names were supposed to be used on maps. They were supposed to be short, according to Mitchell and others. But in this case, the cartographers have included an array of names, and they've also included alternate names, European names and Aboriginal names as well. And Paul Carter suggested that the use of Aboriginal names on European maps is purely rhetorical, because all of these, that maps are always about colonisation, they're all always about domination. And even if those names are used inappropriately, it still raises questions about the competing uses. Questions about the competing uses of the environment. These last two images are of commercial fishers. The first one from 1879 it was an image which was completed after there was a government visit to Painesville on the Gippsland Lakes, and the artist chose to show an almost pre-industrial scene of commercial fishing. If he'd done it the previous day, there would have been about 80 people there, half of whom were children. But there's no sense in this photo of that sort of thing. And this romanticising of commercial fishers, and a journalist at the time acknowledged it as commercial fishing is a natural and time-honoured industry. But the romanticism of commercial fishing, which was evident here, had changed by just 4 or 5 years later, with a representation of commercial fishing which suggests that there's an element of class, with the person standing is Mr. Leggett, who was the contractor who built the jetty on which these people are standing. The person sitting is Mr. Colgate, who owns the pub, which is actually just down at the end of the jetty. And James Smith is the fisherman who's standing, bending over, and the other one is a Mr. James. But what it suggests is the changing fishing environment on the lakes, and as it's becoming more industrialised, there's also a sense of class differences between those who fished and those who didn't. So that's that's a taste of different aspects of the research. My intention with Imagined Natures was to demonstrate that the experiences of subduing the environment on the Gippsland Lakes was never a clear process, and it was never, and there were always consequences which were involved in that subjugation. And it was also an element which was part of the colonial world in other places and other waterways. Thank you.